Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's August the 21st, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, obviously the first thing I need to talk about this week is the nigger rioting in St. Louis, but before I do, I need to drop in a few quick housekeeping notes. First off, I was rather surprised that only one person emailed me in hysterics last week, accusing me of having lost my marbles when I allowed so much as the mention of aliens on the show. Now, that's interesting. A lot of people did email me what were not exactly pro-alien comments, but interesting responses. I don't think the NF is in danger of becoming an extraterrestrial cult anytime soon, but a lot of us are clearly into science fiction and the paranormal, which is cool because so am I. Now, for the record, I will say again, I actually do believe in aliens on a theoretical basis. Now, to me, the idea that in this whole vast universe we are the only intelligent sentient beings in existence is simply nuts. Oh, I'm also informed from several sources that the original lizard people internet guy pronounces his name David Icke. Secondly, many thanks to Comrade Jason in Oklahoma for the 100 or so new brochures you printed off on your personal computer. We might have enough to include one with the next Northwest Observer, as I mentioned last week. Could you please send me the updated templates for that one so I can pass it on to the email list and maybe some others might decide to run us off a few copies sufficient to where I can include them with intro packs. Now, I've been getting a series of emails from one of our comrades in the UK named Lewis, including a short audio file which I'll play in due course. And we have a lot of fans in Europe and Australia, especially in the UK and Sweden for some reason. Anyway, Comrade Lewis has just discovered the Northwest Independence novels, and like most people who have just discovered the Northwest novels, he is all afire with enthusiasm and he wants to come home. Trouble is, since he lives in Britain, he is confronted with a massive immigration problem. Now, do not be fooled by the fact that Obama has abolished the southern border and is allowing tens of thousands of little brown babies to just come toddling across the Rio Grande at will. Those little brown bambinos are being brought here for a reason, which is to serve as anchor babies to bring in their families who will all, in the fullness of time, become future Democrat voters. Now, if you have a white skin, you are not wanted in this country, at least not by the ruling party. If you have a white skin, every conceivable legal and bureaucratic obstacle will be placed in the way of your getting into this country. Now, on March 16th, 2012, I posted a separate short podcast on American immigration for foreign white nationalists. You guys in Europe and Australia need to track that one down on the website and listen to it, or use the link I posted on Thought Crime sometime last week. Now, that's the podcast for March 16th, 2012. Since then, we have had at least one guy that I know of make a serious attempt to try and get somebody over here to offer him a job and sponsor him to ICE, and he hasn't had any luck so far. Of course, the problem is that coming from a socialist country, Sweden, his work history consists mostly of government jobs, and there is no real need for us to import bureaucrats from Sweden. We have more than enough of our own here. I really wish that I could be more help, because you European guys get all this in a way that native-born white Americans just don't. But the fact is that if you live in the UK or Europe, you are faced with some pretty serious obstacles to coming home. And I know a lot of you are extremely angry and frustrated at these stupid American white boys who have the full legal residence and freedom of movement across the continent. And all they need is to just throw their gear in the back of a U-Haul and hit the road in a northwesterly direction. Something that I know you guys in Europe or Oz or New Zealand would give your right arms to be able to do. Okay, back to the comfort zone we go now. The nigger riots in St. Louis. The most common question I'm getting is this it, Harold? Could this be it? Could the balloon finally be going up? No, I don't think so, although it could develop into that, maybe. For one thing, so far the only death is the so-called gentle giant, the 6'4", 300-pound nigger who robbed a convenience store of a box of Swisher Sweets to make marijuana joints out of, and who was so high that when a cop told him to get off the street and back onto the sidewalk, all 300 pounds of him charged the police car and tried to grab the cop's gun through the window. Apparently, from what I can tell, the Zionist regime's security protocols are still functioning, and the militarized police have so far been pretty effective in keeping the Booga Booga confined to a radius of about 6 blocks in Ferguson, Missouri. Also, remember that you are seeing niggers looting and stealing things like beauty products and iPhones. What you're not seeing is niggers seriously attacking the power structure or invading white neighborhoods or attempting to overthrow anything. The Molotov cocktails sailing towards the police lines appear to be pyrotechnics for the media cameras. Molotov cocktails are not anti-personnel weapons. Not usually, anyway. They are anti-property weapons, and so far as I can tell, they are not being used to set any serious fires. These niggers aren't actually burning down their own neighborhood, which is usually the mark of a genuine Munkoid riot. Basically, the niggers have seen an opportunity, and they're acting like naughty children and being deliberately rambunctious. Just like Occupy Wall Street, they have a fairly good sense of just how far they can go. I get the distinct feeling, just from the media coverage, that a lot of this has been staged and it's being used as part of the Democrat midterm election campaign. Munkoids posturing for the media and getting their t-shirt-covered faces on CNN and MSNBC is one thing. Actually hurting anybody or going into a white neighborhood where there might be citizen resistance or serious property damage might occur, where rich people, even Democrats, might actually get hurt, that's something else. It's pretty clear that that will not be allowed in St. Louis. Now, I noticed that the militarized police were on display in Ferguson in a big way, possibly as an advertisement for why they need to be militarized. Now, some of the lefty libs have noticed and they're screaming about it on their websites. But militarized or otherwise, the cops' paychecks are still being direct deposited into their bank accounts and the money will still buy something, so they're remaining loyal to the people who pay them and they will not allow this mess to get out of hand. Now, this is not the Matt Bracken scenario we talked about a few weeks ago. The EBT system is still functioning and there is no genuine desperation among the blacks for food and water and other basics. This is also a localized incident so far, and for the time being, there doesn't seem to be any danger of it spreading beyond St. Louis. Although a change in that situation is always possible, and that could alter my perspective on things if it spreads. That's one thing about setting fires. You never know when the wind is going to change, and a few sparks might land in the wrong place, and the thing might get out of hand. That could still happen here. Now, another thing, I had some emails from white people who suggested that the NF ambulance chase this. Ambulance chasing is a somewhat less common old white nationalist tactic. It's different from littering, i.e. leaflet drops. Ambulance chasing is basically what guys like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and Gloria Oliver do, except they're black or female or liberal in some way, so that they can get away with it. Indeed, they make a living at it. Now, the vague idea circulating is for a bunch of us to get in our cars and we all drive to St. Louis and pass out leaflets or business cards. I'm not too worried about this actually happening because I think, as usual with us, the moment of truth will come when it's time to actually turn off the computer and go out and get into the car and start up the engine and start driving, but we'll see. Now, basically, ambulance chasing is figuring out where the TV cameras are pointing and trying to jump in front of them. Kind of a, hi, Ma, type of thing. Or like that guy who always shows up in crowd scenes or football games holding up that sign with a Bible verse, John 22 something, whatever it is. Look, I've said this before, and I'll say it again, but don't worry, I'm not mad or even particularly disappointed. Now, after 42 years of this, I'm pretty much resigned and accepting of the fact that all those decades of experience I have under my belt are not teachable. And all of you are going to have to go through my learning curve, hopefully learning a lot faster than I did, so you won't be too old and sick to do anything once you finally do gain wisdom. I have told you what we need to do, or at least what we need to be prioritizing. I know you all hate this, you don't want to hear it, but we have to start building the infrastructure that we have to actually accomplish something, i.e. an independent nation. We have to start doing now the kind of thing that we should have been doing 50 years ago. We didn't, and I apologize for that. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be rushing to catch up. Now, the first step is to form communities all over the Pacific Northwest, dozens of them, where groups of at least 8 or 10 non-dysfunctional white nationalists live within half an hour's drive of one another and interact face-to-face on a regular basis, not on a computer screen. That is what we need to be doing now. It is perfectly legal. The moving part of it is difficult, but still not impossible. And it is personally beneficial to you once all the initial difficulties are overcome and you've gotten your ass out of that niggerized slum in Philadelphia or Trenton, New Jersey or Jacksonville, Florida, or wherever the hell you're living now. This is what we need to be doing right now. If you won't do it, I can't make you, but I'm not going to give up. Anyway, I promised you'd hear from our new comrade in Airstrip 1.
Greetings, comrade. This is the Northwest Nationalist. Now, I've got a little axe to grind about practical skills here, so I'll get right into it. When you come to the homeland, what do you plan to take with you? And we aren't talking material goods here. I'll leave that to Harold. The Führer said that idealism must replace materialism, and he was absolutely right in this idea. When you come to the homeland, what are you bringing in terms of knowledge? I myself have not made migration just yet, and I'll tell you why. It's because I don't want to turn up at Harold's doorstep like some other people have, with no plan, or very little cash, or no assets, or all of the above. I want to be able to say, I made a scouting trip. I had a look at some accommodation, and I've already got it sorted out myself. But that isn't all. I don't want to turn up without the practical knowledge that this movement clearly needs. Have you ever considered the crap that Zog puts in our food? I'm often reminded of Parsons' canteen remark in the film adaptation of Orwell's 1984. Double plus good this. Do you know, I don't think there's a single piece of meat in this stew. Looks like meat, tastes like meat, isn't meat at all. Double plus good. We need skills, now more than ever, and all of these skills are at your fingertips. Firstly, you can find almost any agricultural guide on the internet in PDF form and print it off. Or, if you don't have a printer, then you can read it online. I myself am currently reading through a vast grouping of topics, including beekeeping and dairy farming. The main question is why? Well, because once we get land, and we're talking land that we can use practically, and we will get this land eventually, we're going to need to put things on it apart from bunkhouses and parade squares. Animals and plants, this is what we're talking about here. The white man shouldn't have to rely on Zog's mass-produced, not-really-meat products, etc., for survival. And if we're clever about it, we'll soon see to it that we are very much able to produce anything that we want and are in the process of becoming the Aryan warrior farmers which Hitler spoke so much of. March ever onwards, comrades.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to tackle a difficult subject. That is the subject of Caribou Ridge. And, you know, because of the time of year it is, I was recently looking to see if there were any books on this topic. And I found a couple of books, one of them by Sarah Weaver, entitled From Ruby Ridge to Freedom, in which Sarah Weaver advocates for her ministry that she's now involved in, which is called Overboard for Jesus. I had some question as to whether I would discuss that book or not, because Sarah Weaver has stated that she doesn't like it when people use her name to advocate for a cause that she does not agree with, and it would seem that she is a mainstream author and does not agree with the Northwest Imperative. And I do respect that, and I was considering not even mentioning her book. However, her book dovetails with another book called Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge. And this was a book that she co-authors with Randy Weaver. Put together, these books really give you a portrait of what the Weaver family, what kind of a life they had, what their ideas were. Now, as far as the siege itself, that's something you can certainly read about in the book Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge, but that's something that has been rehashed so many times, and we all know the story pretty much. I would be more interested in talking about the prelude to that, the lifestyle that the Weavers had prior to that and how they came to that lifestyle. In Randy's section of Federal Siege, he writes that people are often caught up in buzzwords. Anybody who wants to separate from the current religious or political system might be termed a separatist, as well as anyone who has pride in their culture. Whereas anyone who loves their country might be called a patriot. People should not be caught up in buzzwords. They should seek the truth. However, as Randy well knows, there is a price to seeking the truth. Now, shortly after the birth of Sarah Weaver, the Weavers started to go on a truth-seeking journey. They started to study history and politics and religion, and they started looking for a church that they could really agree with. But they failed to find one, and so they started having Bible studies at home. Now, this was back when they were still living in Iowa, and they were trying to actively share what they had learned with others. Now, at one point, the Weavers decide that they want to move to the Pacific Northwest, and for some reason they decide that they're moving to Idaho. And they really want to be self-sufficient. They want to come together as a family. And in a lot of ways, they actually want to emulate the Amish. As the eldest child, it's true that Sarah and also Sam, they had to, and well, Rachel too, but she was very young at this point. They had to give up TV, and they also had to give up graven images, which is something that the Amish follow as well. So they couldn't have any toys with any faces on them, for example, and they also stopped taking photographs, and they stopped celebrating holidays with pagan roots. Now, this lifestyle meant that life was difficult for Sarah in the sense that the family had a very primitive life in Idaho, and part of the reason for this, well, for one thing, they didn't have electricity or running water. They would have had running water except for the fact that they built their house on very rocky ground, which took advantage of the view, but they were unable to run the pipes underground. So they ended up having to rely on a stream, which was basically Ruby Creek drainage. As a result, they had water year-round, but Sarah had to do a lot of water hauling, and she also had to do a lot of babysitting. And Sarah really loved her parents, but she found this life of many chores to be difficult, and the fact was that she had not actively chosen this life for herself. Now, Vicki earned an associate's degree, and this was done in order to homeschool her children. And she did a wonderful job with Sarah, because when Sarah was forced to move to Iowa and enter into a public high school, Sarah was able to make A's and B's. However, adjusting to mainstream life was very difficult for Sarah. She found it difficult to get along with other students, and she also had a lot of illnesses because she'd never been exposed to various viruses and bacteria during her childhood because she was always homeschooled. But despite what happened, Sarah really fell in love with the Northwest, and I think that speaks powerfully for the draw that the Northwest has. I was also very impressed in reading The Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge because I think it really shows how courageous Randy is. Even after all that happened, Randy really advocates for independent thought. And given all he's been through, that's really amazing. He could just as easily write something totally different, but he's really a man of tremendous conviction. But there is a lesson in all of this, and that is following your instincts. Now, from the moment that Randy met Frank and Gus, the two suspicious characters that he unfortunately became involved with, he was suspicious of both of them. But he must have put these suspicions aside because he continued to be acquainted with them over the years, and eventually, when he became rather desperate for extra money, he got drawn into a gun deal, which obviously he should not have. Now, needless to say, things deteriorated from that point. Really, this was a time when I think the government agencies were very embarrassed by Bob Matthews and the Order, and they were really taking it out on Randy and his family, unfortunately. Again, there's really no need to rehash what happened. But reading The Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge has really convinced me that Randy Weaver is very courageous, and, or I should say highly courageous, in writing this book, and I'm surprised that I never read it before now. This book has been around since 1999, and you can get it on Amazon. You can even get a signed copy. So this is really going to be, I'm never going to weed this from my collection. I'm going to keep this book. Randy and Sarah, but I think especially Randy, really says, you know, come to your own conclusions through reading this book. You know, at the end of the day, I think what happened with the Weavers was really larger than all of them. It's tragic, really, needless to say, and anything you say about this event sounds, in a way, it's hard to do it justice, and that's why I really don't even want to discuss the siege itself. I just think that the Weaver family were caught up in a certain zeitgeist, a certain wave that we are all caught up in this movement, caught up in something larger than ourselves. I respect the fact that Sarah really doesn't find the movement to be her cup of tea, and I understand that, and she has every right to her opinion as well. So if you want a complete viewpoint, I would say read both books, look them up on Amazon, and it's hard to know what to say in a case like this. I'm at a loss for words in this situation, but I would say take care, always follow your instincts, and hail victory, comrades.
You know, I'm going to be 61 years old in about 3 weeks' time. I'm not sure whether that officially makes me a codger, a geezer, or a coot, but I'm going to play some old codger music for you. I remember this one from my first sock hop when I was about 11 years old, I think. Don't ask. This is the Everly Brothers.
Okay, baby, you wake up and find that you're alone. 'Cause Well, good morning and welcome. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is Thursday, July 24th, 2014, and my guest today is author and social engineer, social architect, Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back to the show.
Okay.
So anyway, I look at this, and there is a great evil in the world, and it's been on the prowl for a long time. And most of its sources really do have Talmudic Jewish roots. Not the only sources. You know, I look at characters like George H.W. Bush. I look at George W. Bush. I look at their malfeasance while in office. I look at Lyndon Johnson. You know, I do look at there is a Jewish contingent to this evil, but it's not exclusively Jewish. So, you know, how do we differentiate? And what kind of a litmus test? Because when it hits the fan, and I think it's going to hit the fan pretty quickly here. You know, the BRICS nations are gaining traction with their effort to create an alternative to the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. And I think if that happens and people begin around the world begin to dump U.S. Denominated bonds and other assets, financial assets, that we could have a really economic collapse in this country before we have anything else. What's your read on this?
Well, you're talking about how you tell the difference. One of my mentors in the white nationalist movement was the late Pastor Robert Miles, and he once told me something which may sound odd, but when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. He said, Judaism is not a race. It's not a racial designation. Judaism is a state of mind. And some of the worst Jews that you will ever come across will have not a drop of Hebrew blood in their veins. I interpret that as Judaism is a state of mind which involves total, complete materialism devoid of any spiritual or cultural element. Both communism and capitalism are purely materialistic worldviews, and both are Jewish. They're opposite sides of the same coin. The only difference is that communism wants an all-powerful state that controls all the wealth and resources, and capitalism advocates an oligarchy of captains of industry, whatever you want to call them, wealthy men who control all the resources and the wealth of the world. And both are equally inimical to the white race, because they view mankind as an economic unit of consumption or production, not a spiritual being, not a moral being, not a human being with a soul, but simply a part for a great machine. And when the part gets worn out, you replace it. While the part is functioning, you have to give it so many cubic meters of living space, so many calories per day. You have to look after its well-being, just like you would look after a draft mule or a horse or something like that. But once horse has finally served his purpose, don't even put him out to pasture. You just basically take him out and shoot him.
Let me interject something here, because this is a conclusion I came to a while back. And you look at how this country had Obamacare forced on it. 78% of the electorate did not want Obamacare. 78% did not want it. Yet these politicians came along and forced it upon us. And you say, yeah, that kind of thing, why? Why would they do that? Why would politicians who depend on votes, if there's no honest voting in this country, but if they depend on votes, why would they force something on the people didn't want it? Then it occurred to me, with the retiring baby boomers, Obamacare is a way to not have to meet their obligations that they've incurred under Social Security. They've already taken a lifetime of money from me that I'm probably never going to see a cent of. I mean, they don't want me to live to be 89 years old and have 24 years on Social Security. They want me to die within 6 months or a year after retiring. They want to work me to death and then put me in my grave. And that's what Obamacare is designed to do.
Well, it's the death panels and so forth. I think personally that Obamacare is just the first step. I kind of now tend to go with the conspiracy theories of some of the right wing in that the purpose of Obamacare is to utterly destroy the private health insurance industry so that they can replace it all with one big, massive, single-payer health service like they have in Britain and in most European socialist countries. And that way, all health care and the resources, which comprise something like 1/6 of the entire American economy right now, will be in the hands of the government. I think Obamacare is just a preliminary step to eliminate all private health insurance and make everyone dependent on the government for its health care, except, of course, I'm sure there will be some kind of private arrangement made for congressmen and media moguls and big officials of the Democratic Party, etc. So, I mean, the elite never live by the laws and the rules that they enforce on other people, so I'm sure their medical care will be top-notch. But again, it has to do with controlling everyone's life from cradle to grave, which is the ultimate aim of socialism, of course. They view men and women as ants. I referred earlier to the movie Soylent Green. That's a very old movie. I don't know how many of your people have seen it, but that pretty much shows what the world is going to be like when resources are scarce and everything is controlled by the government and the population simply explodes. In the movie, of course, since it was in the early 70s, the overpopulated areas were all white. But in reality, of course, the big, huge masses of populations are going to be brown and black. They're going to be confined to the cities. That's another part of the liberal agenda. They want everybody living in about 100 urban areas. They don't like this idea of white people living out in the countryside where they're close to nature, they're earning their own living, and they're getting ideas. They want to eliminate the private automobile so that everyone is dependent on the government for transportation. There is a whole agenda here which you can get a glimpse of in some of these liberal websites that I look at. They're going to eliminate the suburbs as entities by creating big, huge sort of condominium-type regional governments that allow government to tax the remaining white people who live in the suburbs and who have, in essence, fled from the cities and their non-white garbage. And they're going to find a way to make white people pay for these big, huge masses of blacks and browns in the cities. They're trying to do this with Detroit now. One of the ways they're trying to pull Detroit out of its bankruptcy is to find some way to extend the tax net to almost all of Michigan and the surrounding areas so that they can make white people start paying taxes to support blacks again. And the agenda is all here. It's there if you know where to look at it. You can see exactly what these people have in mind for us. You can see exactly what's coming, and nothing is being done about it, because the only thing right now that will be of any effect now that electoral politics is useless is the use of the Second Amendment, and we're simply too timid and frightened to do it. They've figured this out, and so I think we're going to see an acceleration over the next few years of the agenda, because they're coming to realize that they don't have anything to worry about.
Well, let us talk about that a little bit, because, you know, they're masters at this. So you look at the genocide in Gaza right now, and this was allegedly because Palestinians had kidnapped three Israeli teenagers. What I'm hearing from the intelligence channels that I have access to is that it was a domestic Israeli intelligence agency that kidnapped and murdered those kids in order to justify an attack on the Palestinians. And now Netanyahu comes out and says Israel has the right to exterminate all 1.8 million people living in Gaza. That's something that they have been masters of. But we as a people have never been able to be that hard or that cold to actually kill our own in order to incite our people.
Well,
9-11, that was a Mossad job. We know that now. I mean,
yeah, we allowed it. I suspect that there were elements in the American government that could have stopped it if they'd wanted to. The thing is, Israel is entirely capable of committing that type of provocation that you mentioned. They've done it before, and I assume you have read a book called By Way of Deception by a Jew named Vladimir Ostrovsky, who kind of later defected from Israel. They don't like him now because he blew the Mossad's secrets. But I think they're also behind things like this business with ISIS in Iraq. And a friend of mine who has an interesting theory, which I think holds a lot of water, and that although Iraq looks like a United States defeat, in actual fact, as far as the long-term agenda of the Zionists went, they succeeded, because the object of that whole thing, since basically early 1990, has been to destroy Iraq as a nation, and in that they have succeeded. So, yeah, there's some pretty nasty, and it's what they're doing in the Ukraine right now. They're trying to set up what amounts to a puppet state in the Ukraine, and the Russians are resisting, and so now all of a sudden, whoopee, we got this Malaysian airliner falling out of the sky, and I've got one source that tells me that they got a problem because they were able to tell that plane was shot down by a missile, but it was an air-to-air missile. Now, granted, something to do with basically if it had been a surface-to-air missile, the infrared homing device would have hit dead center of the aircraft, but air-to-air missiles home in on the heat source, which is the engines and so forth. I don't fully understand it all. And
let me give you the latest on this that we have from veteranstoday.com. We've confirmed that there were two Israeli F-15, U.S.-supplied Israeli F-15s in Azerbaijan that could not be accounted for that day. We know that. And we also have heard that perhaps a bomb was loaded onto the plane by the Israeli company out of the Amsterdam airport, Schiphol, which is the same Israeli security company that allowed the shoe bomber to get on without a passport and all that. So we've got these two competing theories. We do have a working group in place that's trying to nail this down to find out exactly what happened. But those are the two relevant theories right now. Either it was an Israeli F-15 flying an American F-15 that we the U.S. gave to them as part of our help them defend themselves from the evil Palestinians, or it was a bomb placed on the plane by the Israeli security company out of Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. One of the two.
No. Anyway, Israel is entirely capable of killing not just their own people, but anybody in order to further their greater agenda. There's just no doubt about that. I mean, their entire history as a so-called nation proves that.
Well, I did an interview on Press TV the other day, and I said it's time for a new American foreign policy. And one of the things we need to do immediately is purge all of the Israeli spies and dual U.S.-Israeli citizens out of our government at every level. That's something that must be done. Until we do that, we've got nothing. But I would call that Israel can no longer be recognized as a Jewish state, that it can be recognized as a Jewish homeland, but not as a Jewish state and not given rights of sovereignty over things because it is a criminal enterprise. It's always been a criminal enterprise. They've had 67 years to get it together. They haven't been able to do it. They don't get along with their neighbors, and they're genocidal in their approach. They want to kill everybody around them. And so the question comes down, we have this group of people globally, and I look at Israel as being the tip of an iceberg. You know, that's just the part you see. But then you look at all of these Zionist, Israeli, Talmudic-type Jews that live in the USA, they live in Great Britain, they live in Germany, they live in Russia, they live everywhere. That's the other 90% of the iceberg you don't see. And these people are hell-bent on killing everyone else. They want to rule the world. They think they're going to be the master race and that God promised them this and all kinds of other crazy stuff. But how do we, as a civilized people, black, brown, Asian, whatever, deal with a race of psychopaths? And that's what they are. There can be no other word for it. They are that misguided. So how do we deal with them? What alternatives do we have?
Well, I think one way or the other, the American lifeline is going to be cut off because I believe, as I've said, that there's going to be a Soviet-style breakup in this country. And eventually, as part of that or as a result of that breakup, the money supply is going to run out. And it's not just going to run out for the EBT cards keeping the minorities from rioting. It's going to run out for little foreign luxuries like Israel. And so the great teat that Israel has been suckling off for the past 67 years is just going to go dry because there just isn't any more money. And so it's possible that the Israelis realize this. I don't know if they do or not. They're not exactly the most sane individuals in the world. And it's entirely possible that they have some kind of Samson or Masada option or whatever, where if they finally realize they're going to go down, they're just going to ignite the whole Middle East and destroy all the oil fields and just take the whole world with them, that they're entirely capable of that.
How do we deal with this? My approach is that if you allow a blackmailer to extort you, take you for something without killing them, you better be prepared to keep paying them for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Now, if they do have nuclear weapons, which I firmly believe that they do,
known that they do. A place called Dimona, that's their main nuclear facility. It's no secret at all that Israel has nuclear weapons.
You know, I think I'd go ahead and take the pain, and I would put out the evacuate order, get everybody out of the cities that we could, let them blow them off, and then we go about and we liquidate Israel and every Israeli, every dual Israeli, everyone who's even sympathetic to them has ever written a pro-Israeli comment on Facebook. We hunt them all down and hang them. I said, that's just me, but I'm sort of passionate.
Well, realistically speaking, see, I don't think we're ever going to get the opportunity to do that. This is another problem with this lack of a plan and sense of drift. A lot of people have the idea that somehow or other we are going to eventually be able to do things again on a nationwide scale, and that somehow or other we're going to acquire the necessary power and influence to do something in the whole continental United States, and it's just not going to happen. See, this is what's happened. All this mass migration over the past 50 years, the crashing white birth rate and the burgeoning black birth rate, so forth and so on, means that there's now something like 150 million non-whites in this country all over in the continent, and we simply do not have the military or the logistic capability of forcibly expelling all these creatures. As much as I hate to say it, they are pretty much here to stay. That was never meant to happen, but it did. And this is why we have to take back a section of the North American continent, expel the non-whites and the garbage and the Jews and whatnot from that area, our homeland, and then fence it off, do whatever we have to do to make sure that that homeland survives so that white people will have a habitat, if you will, where we can once again grow physically and mentally and emotionally and morally stronger, and where we can raise new generations of white children who are free of this Judaic pollution. And then maybe, who knows, 100, 200 years from now when that has happened and the rest of the continent is in total, utter chaos, but there's this one bright, shining city on a hill in the Northwest where white people control things and white people still exist, maybe at some point in the future we can consider using our superior technology and whatever we can to just...
Well, aren't you going to have the same problem? Aren't you going to have the same problem the USA has, though? I mean, that's what attracted them all here in the first place. That's why all of the blacks and browns from around the world still want to come here, is because we have running water. We have toilets that flush. And speaking of which, what do you think about going on in Detroit with this water issue up there? What's your opinion on that?
Detroit, okay. I think, first off, the city's going to cave and turn the water back on because this society just is not equipped to deal with squalling blacks. When the blacks squall and squeak and complain, they're going to get what they want. I think somebody just had the idea that it's ridiculous. These people aren't paying their water bills. They've been getting free water for years and sometimes generations. Damn it all, why don't we make them obey the law and pay their water bills? And that idea doesn't seem to have flown. It would be interesting if they got all hard-assed on it and persisted, refused to turn the water back on, because that is another thing that would provoke the blacks into rioting. And on my own show, we've been talking about a Matt Bracken article called When the Music Stops, and it discusses the various scenarios whereby massive non-white rioting would take place. His theory is that it will come when the EBT cards get cut off.
Well, let's talk about that on the other side. We got music coming up now. This is our top of the hour break, and let's talk about that first thing when we get back. Okay, be right back, folks. More with Harold Covington. Stick with us. Got 5 minutes.
Right. And now for something nice and Irish and thoroughly depressing. This is Clannad. Thank you. Now, you didn't think I was going to let Who Guards the Guardians slip again this week, did you?
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stares a stranger. Read every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number and taken away your name.
On February the 21st, 2013, the CNN website published an article that, so far as I can recall, attracted no attention whatsoever. It was one of those stories that appeared and then sank into the overwhelming whirling vortex of the internet, which the power structure has found is just as effective at burying information that they don't want discussed as any actual act of suppression they could attempt. Now, that's the thing about the internet, there's just so much of it out there that all the good stuff tends to get just lost in the shuffle. Anyway, this article from CNN contained a summary of case reports from the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility from 2010 to 2012. During that period, the FBI officially disciplined 1,045 employees out of a total of 36,000 for a variety of violations of the rules and just plain grotty, grody, bad acts. 85 agents were fired during this period, which may not sound like many out of a total of 36,000, but you have to remember that, among other things, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is an institutional master of the cover-up. I mean, look at how long they kept Mary's secret. In an institution which specializes in burying inconvenient facts, these were just the cock-ups that were so bad, so egregious, that even the FBI couldn't overlook them. Now imagine how much bad craziness and weird behavior was and is covered up in the Bureau on a regular basis. It turns out that the strong-jawed and steely-eyed Aaron Hotchners, Jack Bowers, and Seeley Booths of Hollywood are, in real life, a bunch of slackers, stumble-bums, drunks, and dopers, and criminals. Some of the merry pranks that our friends in the silk suits got up to in just those two recent years were, let's see, bugging their boss's office, which I think is hysterical in view of the way they like to spy on us norms. Sending naked photos around to coworkers of the opposite sex, or of the same sex. Sexting in the office. FBI agents were repeatedly caught paying for sex in massage parlors, and on more than one occasion were picked up by local vice cops who were raiding massage parlors and other cat houses. Now, one rather prudish and politically correct female assistant director named Candace Will was especially pissed off by what she referred to as a quote-unquote rash of sexting cases involving employees who are using their government-issued devices to send lurid texts and nude photos. I think that seems to have gotten her madder than anything else, the fact that they're using their government-issue equipment to do this mess. I have this vision of some FBI agent on the witness stand in some high-profile mob case or narcotics case, and something he has on his personal assistant or his cell phone is deemed to be evidence, and so he has to hand the phone to the bailiff to put it up on the screen for the judge and the jury, and the bailiff clicks the wrong file, and here's Special Agent Jack Bauer wannabe waving his Johnson bar like he was a Jewish New York congressman or mayoral candidate. Anyway, Assistant Director Candace said, and I quote, "We're hoping that getting the message out in the quarterlies is going to teach people as well as their supervisors that you can't do this stuff. When you are given an FBI BlackBerry, it's for official use. It's not to text the woman in another office who you found attractive or send a picture of yourself in a state of undress. It's not why we provide you with an FBI BlackBerry." And by the way, just to show that the FBI is no longer an exclusive boys' club like it was back in Mary's day, it seems that some of the worst offenders in the sexting and the dirty phone and internet selfie departments are female agents. One woman agent used a personal cell phone to send nude photographs of herself to other employees. Doesn't say how many or under what circumstances, which quote-unquote adversely affected the daily activities of several squads. So she was sending naked pictures of herself all over the office, looks like. Now, I would really love to know the backstory behind that one. Another female FBI agent emailed a nude photograph of herself to her ex-boyfriend's wife, kind of a revenge porn kind of thing. Now, interestingly, both of these female agents received 10-day suspensions. Can you imagine what would have happened to a male agent who did something like that? Some did, of course. Now, the CNN article isn't clear, but my guess is that the male agents got the book thrown at them, and it wasn't any 10-day suspension thing. The internal reports from the OPR over the 2-year period don't specify job titles or names or the location of the FBI agents involved, and yet they do provide the exact details of their assorted screw-ups. Now, my favorite is a female FBI agent who, quote, engaged in a romantic relationship with a former boyfriend whom she subsequently married, knowing that he was an addict and a drug dealer. Female Agent X also lied under oath when questioned during the administrative inquiry about her husband's activities. No hint as to the race of this female agent, but I would be willing to hazard a guess that her pigmentation is not pale. I would love to have been a fly on the wall in that household when they both came home from work at their respective trades. Hi, honey, how was your day today? Item, another FBI agent, quote-unquote, hid a recording device in a supervisor's office. In addition, without authorization, the employee made copies of the supervisor's negative comments about employee that employee located by conducting an unauthorized search of the supervisor's office and briefcase. It is said that the agent under investigation also lied to investigators during the course of the inquiry. You know, when us mere pale peasants lie to the FBI, it's obstruction of justice and prison time. Nope, so far as the CNN report says, although some of the screw-up agents were fired, no criminal charges were brought against any of them for anything. Item, an FBI supervisor repeatedly committed check fraud and quote-unquote lacked candor under oath, i.e. committed perjury, which comes as naturally to FBI agents as breathing. The CNN article doesn't say whether this was an actual SSA, a supervisory special agent who lied under oath and got away with it. Item, one FBI agent, and I paraphrase a bit, but only a bit, was involved in a domestic dispute at his mistress's apartment requiring police intervention. Employee was drunk and uncooperative with police and refused to relinquish his weapon, making it necessary for the officers to physically subdue him, take the loaded weapon, and place employee in handcuffs. Oh, God, I hope the local cops videotaped that. If they did, then I imagine bootleg copies of that video are all over the net somewhere that other local cops around the country can see it. Item, FBI agents rocked up a raft of DUI charges. The article doesn't say how many. That was during a 2-year period, remember. Item, an FBI agent used a stolen credit card to buy gas. Doesn't say whether or not it was for his official FBI vehicle. Item, an FBI agent was caught and arrested in a child pornography sting operation. Other shenanigans and hijinks among the silk-suited crowd included, item, several incidents of FBI agents of both sexes sleeping with informants. Item, a male agent made a sex tape with his girlfriend, which he then posted to the internet. There were repeated incidents of agents tapping into FBI databases for unauthorized searches, i.e. personal monkey shines for business or pleasure. Most likely, some of those FBI agents were selling the information on to private investigators, lawyers, that sort of stuff. There were repeated, I mean boku, incidents in every office from the J. Edgar building on down to the field offices of agents viewing pornography on bureau computers. There was a blizzard of drunk driving arrests. There were numerous arrests of FBI agents by local police for domestic violence during this 2-year period. An FBI agent was arrested while masturbating in the women's bathroom of a university. Doesn't say here whether it was a male or a female agent. Item, something referred to as debauched fraternization between agents stationed at the Guantanamo Bay prison, which I suspect is the interrogators getting turned on by the torture and slipping into a broom closet for a quickie, while some Apu from a Quickie Mart in Springfield was lying on the floor of his cell bleeding and screaming. Item, a New York FBI agent passed sensitive information to his actress girlfriend on the Anthony Pelicano case. Item, a sex tape scandal at an FBI field office. Not clear what the nature of that scandal was. Item, a female FBI agent was accused of sexual harassment in India, of all places. Doesn't say whether she was harassing men or women, locals, or other agents. Or maybe the sacred cows. Item, a married male FBI agent brutally beating and kidnapping his girlfriend. Item, a male FBI agent sleeping with a Chinese spy. Item, a married FBI agent named John Guandolo sleeping with a federal witness and other female FBI agents. It says here that Mr. Guandolo's sexual proclivities, quote-unquote, jeopardized the William Jefferson case as he slept with a federal witness while serving as her driver. Kind of a bureau version of driving Miss Daisy. Now, this one actually hit the media during the trial of corrupt nigger Congressman William Jefferson. You know, the coon who had $100,000 in cool cash in his freezer? The witness's name was Laurie Modi. And apparently, when Agent Guandolo was assigned to bodyguard duty, he got a little too involved with the body he was guarding. Maybe someday they'll make a TV movie about it. Look, next time these Nimrods come knocking on your door and doing their Jack Bauer impressions and trying to get you to talk to them and turn you into a snitch, just remember who you're dealing with. There are no more good guys and bad guys in Obama's America, except to the point where we're the guys who at least have good intentions, unlike them. Basically, the FBI is not a law enforcement agency and hasn't been for a long time. They're Obama's muscle. Leg breakers for the Democratic Party like the kind Mayor Daley used to hire for a dime a dozen on Election Day back in Chicago. They're just another armed gang like the Cosa Nostra or the Crips or the cartels. They're drunks and bullies and sexual perverts, just like the people who pay them. They have no moral authority to demand anything of you, and you don't need to give them the time of day.
Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number, oh, they've taken away your name.
Now, instead of something Irish and depressing, we'll have something Scottish and rambunctious. This is the Tannehill Weavers.
There were three gypsies in a row, and oh, but they were bonny, oh, they sang say sweet and say complete, stone in the heart of a lady, oh, laddie, oh, laddie, oh, follow the gypsy laddie, oh.
Take out that silking gun and put on the tartan radio, and you'll come over the speedline licht and follow the gypsy laddio. On castle seats come painting, inquiring for his lady-o. All the hens is run and the hawks is flown, and the gypsies are warrior lady-o. Laddio, laddio, follow the gypsy laddio. Laddio, laddio, follow the gypsy laddio. To me, the black, my case can soon be ready, oh. All meat and drink, I wanna taste, till I get back my lady, oh. He's from east, he's from west, till he come to yonder boggy, oh. And there he spied the wolf of maid in the arms of the gypsy laddie, oh.
Laddie, oh, laddie, oh, follow the gypsy laddie, oh.
Will you come with me, my lady, oh? And I swear by the soft times by my side, the black banner shall steal me, oh. I wanna come to you, my honey, and my heart. Wanna come to you, my dearie, oh. Till I drank to grease the brood and axe in the water of weary, oh.
Laddie, oh, laddie, oh. Follow the gypsy laddie, oh. Laddie, oh, laddie, oh. Follow the gypsy laddie, oh. Laddie, oh, laddie, oh. Follow the gypsy laddie, oh. Laddie, oh, laddie, oh. Just like you.
Right. Running long and still got things to do today, so I'll wind this up. Now, I don't know if Andy had one coming for me this week, but if he sends one, I'll podcast it next week, and so he'll get a week off. Now, we've been talking about the whole Rotary Club approach versus the secret squirrel method, insofar as constantly hiding can be called a method, and I'll try to sum this up for the time being, although I'm sure we'll be getting back to it on numerous occasions in the future. Look, let me sum up this whole situation the way I see it now. It's going to sound depressing and negative, but for God's sake, let's be honest. Things are depressing and negative for white people and have been almost since any of us can remember. Like I said earlier, I'm going to be 61 next month, and I couldn't tell you when the last hope for white people left this country. I think maybe it was at the time of Watergate. In point of fact, Richard Nixon was actually a pretty good president compared to the morons and the criminals who came after him, but there were people who never got over the fact that the media were allowed to seize control of the narrative and, in essence, forcibly eject a sitting president of the United States from office over nothing. Now, make no mistake. What happened in 1974 was a coup d'etat. Now, maybe that was when the last of the hope died. I don't know, and I'm rambling again. But let's be honest. Of the thousands of people listening to these words right now, I doubt if I could find 100 among you who really, in their hearts, believe that we can win. And I think that is probably at the root cause of the bulk of the white character problem. Why exert yourself for something that you are convinced is hopeless? Now, the overwhelming majority of the people who are involved in white nationalism are involved out of guilt, because they know what is wrong, they know what they should be doing to fix it, they know they don't have the balls to do that, and they are deeply ashamed of themselves. Now, I hate to sound like a liberal, but I do understand that feeling bad about yourself is no joke. In 1968, when I was 15, something happened that made me feel so bad about myself that I swore to spend the rest of my life fighting against this evil, even though in those days I had only the vaguest notion what that evil comprised. Most of you guys know what you should be doing. You know that you're too cowed and timid and frightened and depressed to even attempt it, and you at least have the good grace to feel absolutely horrible about yourselves because of that. So you dabble, just enough to salve your conscience a little. Now, ever since the invention of the internet, dabbling has been really easy peasy. I mean, before the internet, you actually had to go to the occasional meeting in a cow pasture or a rented motel banquet room, and there was always a chance that some FBI agent might jot down your license number. Or you might get caught the wrong place at the wrong time and find yourself in the middle of something physical or something that might get your face in the papers. But with the internet, it's now all nice and safe and anonymous, and you can massage away on that wounded conscience with all kinds of cyber games and yet be completely safe. But the fact is, you can't. Now, I think we all knew it long before Edward Snowden, but now we have no more excuse to pretend that we don't know. It is simply beyond the bounds of credibility that you have never sent an email with the word nigger or kike in it, or which expressed some kind of politically incorrect thought. And that email was intercepted and archived. It is now sitting in a database in West Virginia or Utah, and sooner or later, when the NSA can get the analysts and the clerical staff, that email will be audited, i.e. read, and you will be nailed. You probably already are anyway, depending on how all this works in real practice, which is something no one knows. Now, my guess is anyone who has ever emailed me about anything is on a list somewhere. So, what do we do, assuming that your conscience is still too raw to let you run away screaming into the night, pleading to be left alone and promising you'll be good from now on? Which is what some of us have done down through the years. You do like I do. You just don't worry about it. You do what is right. You say what is true, and you fear no one. Because that is how a man of self-respect and moral fiber lives his life. You hope that God will sustain you and keep the evil men away from your door, but if he doesn't, and if the beast comes for you one day, then such is life. As Shakespeare said in Julius Caesar, cowards die many times before their death. The valiant never taste of death but once. Now, it's true that I have one advantage over almost all of you, and that is that because of the assistance which a small number among you give me, I am financially bulletproof. And I am not subject to what the neo-Marxist pond scum of the blogs call economic discipline. I have no job they can threaten, while most of you do. It is true that I have no family, no hostages to fortune which the Jews and their lickspittles can threaten. Many of you do. I get that. I'm not judging any of you. I went beyond that point long ago. I know that you are all doing all you can, or all you think you can. The problem is, until you do more, much more, the horror will continue. What you need to do, and what the party needs to help you do, is to work within the parameters of the three C's. No, not the three C's in our organizational letters. Those are confidential. Now, you might call these the public three C's. You need to serve the cause of the Northwest American Republic with courage, caution, and common sense. Now, that's what it takes. Just those three things, courage, caution, and common sense. Find the right balance between those three attributes, and I think you've got about a 90% chance of surviving until we get to the fun part. But for now, our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.